Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
It's a culture that's inclusive and accessible, right? It encourages us. It pushes us to become the best.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Zataro. This is episode 169, a talk with Martha Diaz. Martha is the founder of the Hip-Hop Education Center, but that's only the latest venture in a lifetime full of advocating for and advancing the culture. She began her career as an assistant to Ted Demme, the creator of Yo MTV Raps, and she hasn't looked back. Martha is the creator of the H2O International Film Festival, a documentary filmmaker herself, a concert promoter who helped put together rap shows in Cuba, and most importantly, a tireless advocate for hip-hop education. Whether she's working with institutions like Cornell University to archive hip-hop's past, or keeping track of, connecting, and enhancing current efforts in hip-hop education with the Hip-Hop Education Center, Martha is always playing a key role in advancing the culture and in helping people learn while using tools they know and can relate to. Martha also brought along a special guest, Summer McCoy. Summer is the founder of the Mixtape Museum, an archive project dedicated to advancing public understanding and appreciation of the art, history, and technique of the mixtape. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it drops, subscribe on iTunes. Once you do that, make sure to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, listen to our interview with another hip-hop archivist, Bill Adler, on episode 43. Also consider helping the show by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some material that sometimes comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. For October, we'll have some very, very special, previously unheard Wu-Tang Clan-related material. Become a patron by October 14th at noon Eastern to get access to the file. If you're curious about any of the songs or clips we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's a couple of the most tireless hip-hop advocates, Martha Diaz and Summer McCoy. I am here with Martha Diaz and Summer McCoy of the Hip-Hop Education Center and many, many other organizations and initiatives that we will get to with time. But the very first, very, very crucial, important thing, Martha, I have to ask you is Ashanti was in Who's the Man?
Oh, my God. Yes, a long time ago. Yeah. I mean, woo. Yes, there were so many people in that movie. I mean,
yeah,
52 artists.
Who's the Man? A film directed by Ted Demme, starring Dr. Dre and Ed Lover, with Dennis Leary, Colin Quinn, and a who's who of hip-hop, including Naughty by Nature, Ice-T, Cypress Hill, Flava Flav, KRS-One, Heavy D, House of Pain, Salt-N-Pepa, Criss Cross, and Bushwick Bill.
Drop it!
Ashanti, the singer, was about 13 years old when she was an extra in this movie. At what point did you realize, like, hey, that's the girl from the movie?
I actually didn't know.
Oh.
Until you told me.
Oh.
So, no, I mean, there were so many people that were in the movie. I can't even keep track. I couldn't keep track. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't supposed to be a casting director. We had a casting director, Jackie Brown, and Winsome Sinclair was the extra casting director. So I kind of pitched in and ended up casting the major hip-hop artists that were there.
Oh, wow. So the people who actually were celebrities at the time, pretty much everyone was in that movie.
Yes.
At one point or another. What was it like being on set with all just 40, 50 extras floating around?
It was great. I mean, I don't know. It was just, this was my first film set. And I was running around and I wasn't really, you know, paying attention to anything. Just I had to make sure that Ted was all right because I was his assistant. Mm-hmm. And I had to make sure the artist showed up. So on one hand, I had one phone talking to artists, and the other phone, I was making sure the walkie-talkie, you know, Ted is not, you know, hollering, Martha! You know, so I was, that's how I was working. So it was good chaos. It was a great time for hip-hop artists to become actors.
Right. Yeah. So I guess that leads me more generally in talking about you. I don't know if it was your first job, but certainly the first job that you have talked about was as Ted Demme's assistant. Ted Demme, you know, obviously a key person in Yo MTV Raps. Were you on set for Yo a lot?
Yes, I started out as an intern in late 1991, and then he hired me the spring, my last semester of school, and so I was on Yo for about a year and a half before we went off to do Who's the Man, and I came back several times to do different specials, and yeah.
Wow. What was that set like?
It was cool. I mean, you're talking to a girl from Jersey, from Paterson, New Jersey.
Right.
You know, I didn't even have MTV. I didn't have cable. I didn't even know, you know, who Ed Lover and Dr. Dre were. And what's crazy is that I was actually hanging out in the club scene in New York. I was hanging out in China Club and the Tunnel and all these other places. And Palladium, and I met Ed Lover. So I knew Ed Lover, but I didn't know he had a show. And so when I got on set, it was like, oh, shit, you know, like, yeah. This is Ed Lover. He was like, hey, what are you doing here? I said, I am working here. I'm your intern. And it was really, you know, exciting for me because I didn't have cable, and I got to see a lot of the videos, and I was just observing the movement, and everybody I heard on the radio, I got to meet, and, you know, working with Fab was a different side of hip-hop, more historical, more informative for me, and so, he would go more out in the field, and Ed Lover and Dr. Dre were inside the studio, so I got to experience it at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. That's right. Fab used to do a lot of those remotes where he'd go out to even different cities in the country.
Yeah, they went to Jamaica. They went to Russia.
This is the flavor here, Kingston. You know, real raw style. What up, man?
Yes, sir.
Y'all, man, respect. Yeah, let's go to the back, man. Peep out that flavor.
Be back. One more young TV rap, St. Petersburg. Russ is in the house, right? Russ is in the house.
I'm Fab Five Freddy, and I'm still hanging out with Eazy-E and NWA in Compton, L.A. Check it out.
Yeah, and early on, I saw hip-hop globalizing, you know, because of Yo MTV Raps.
And that actually ultimately ended up being a little bit of an issue, right, where you were like, hey, this show doesn't really have an international perspective, and you kind of tried to do something about that.
That's right. I tried to create a Hip Mundo show. It actually, you know, I pitched it to MTV as an international hip hop show, and they said, well, you know, you should try it in Spanish. And I was like, okay, how do you do an international hip hop show in Spanish? I said, fuck it, I'll do it. $5,000, I'll do a pilot. Yeah, so I did it. And I got Cypress Hill and Rocksteady Crew. And at the time, K7 was hot and Trilogy was hot. And so I interviewed all of them. And when MTV Latino saw the show, they said, you know what? Latin America's not into hip hop.
Oh my God.
And so there went my idea, and nobody has done an international hip-hop show.
Wow.
And I think, you know, that's deliberate.
How do you mean?
Well, I think, you know, America is so interested in making money that any outside influence, any outside artist that will take money away from the U.S. is problematic. And I think, you know, it's deliberate.
Okay.
I won't get into too much politics.
No, please. don't be shy about that.
Maybe later.
Yeah. So the thing that brings you both here is the Hip Hop Education Center. So what is that exactly?
Well, so after Yo, MTV Raps, and Who's the Man, and The Ref.
I was minding my own business, breaking into this house when I ran into this dog. I hate this dog. I took those people hostage.
What are you going to do, shoot me?
Go ahead.
Shoot her.
I hate these people.
Why don't you eat something?
Why don't you eat, kids?
And Dangerous Mind.
As I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and realize there's nothing left.
Who are those kids, rejects from hell?
No. The kids with high IQs and low grades.
But I got a low.
All you gotta do is get their attention.
Once a Marine, always a Marine.
All these films that I worked on, I really just got fed up because I felt like they weren't really capturing hip-hop culture. And I wanted to, I wanted the masses to learn what I was really learning as I was working on Yo and finding out more about the culture. And so I became an independent producer and director. And the RZA was the first to become my executive producer.
Right, he executive produced that documentary you did.
Yes.
The true essence of hip-hop culture really unites people and opens their minds to so many things. And I think it's really important for people to learn the aesthetic expressions of hip-hop culture and celebrate those.
Very short. It was actually just a pilot, but it became a short doc. But it was called H2O, Hip Hop Odyssey, because I wanted to, you know, depict the international scene.
Mm-hmm. And it's about sort of all the different, you sort of outline the different elements of hip hop and
right.
talk to a few people in,
yes.
in each. Yeah.
And so that, you know, was working for a minute. And then, you know, I got all these opportunities to screen it at film festivals and schools and museums. And then, you know, this one film festival, this so-called urban film festival, told me that I was in. And then all of a sudden, last minute, they said I was out of the program because I was bumped because of a love in hip hop, a love in basketball type of movie. And I was like, what? I am going to make my own film festival. This will never happen again to another film, hip hop filmmaker. And so I created the Hip Hop Odyssey International Film Festival.
This week's Hip Hop Odyssey International Film Festival in New York includes entries by high school students from around the country.
And it's not necessarily videos, it's not necessarily gangster movies, but movies about AIDS, movies about homosexuality. Every issue that you deal with in your community, you can talk about using hip hop.
Ran for 5 years, and we, you know, I didn't know what the market was like, but the first year we had 43 submissions. By the fifth year, we had 105 submissions.
Wow.
And people were creating films to premiere at our film festival. And I just got burnt out. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I was upset that I was providing a great platform that everyone was uniting at this platform, you know, pioneers, filmmakers, educators, artists, and I wasn't making money. I wasn't sustaining myself, and I was a single mom with two kids. So I went back to school. But even before that, I started the education initiative because I was substituting and I was teaching and I became a teaching fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And I was using hip hop in the classroom, and the principal was like, what are you doing? The other kids are going into your classroom. I'm like, I'm just showing hip hop movies, bringing in tapes at the time, you know, magazines, hip hop magazines. And I realized that, wait, if I'm doing it, then there must be other people doing it. And when Trisha Wang came over to the film festival and started the youth category, mm-hmm. She asked me, what else you want to do? I said,
And that was films by high school students?
Films by high school students.
Mm-hmm.
she asked me, what else you want to do? I said, you know what? This hip hop education movement is starting. And I want to put out a call and see who else is doing it. And long and behold, I mean, there were like 30 educators, teaching artists that came from around the country. And we met at the Brooklyn, at the Bronx Museum. And that started the Hip Hop Education Summit. And we met annually and we just discussed best practices and showed models. And that was it. Mm-hmm. So after I got burnt out and I went back to school and I was like, okay, I got to find out what's wrong. What's wrong with my model? Why isn't it making money? I took a social entrepreneurship track and I realized that we're doing all this wonderful work. We are changing lives. We're saving lives. But there is no evidence that we exist and that we're making an impact. And so that's when it hit me, when I said, okay, we need to create some sort of center that can measure and analyze and assess and create reports on our movements. And that's where the Hip Hop Education Center got launched.
Okay. And Summer, when did you become involved in the Education Center?
Just recently. But I met Martha at a hip hop conference at NYU a couple years ago, Show Improve hip hop conference. And I was really interested in the hip hop archival panel that they had, because at the time I was just conceptualizing the Mixtape Museum and what it was going to be. And I said, wow, they have a panel dedicated to hip hop and archiving. I need to be there. So I actually stood up someone for lunch and went. And I ended up, after the symposium, I ended up going to dinner with them. And Martha and I kept in touch since then. But I, you know, over the years, have looked at her as a mentor, because she was, I mean, when I was there at the symposium, I was like, that's Martha Diaz. Like, I knew who she was, you know. So I guess we've been watching each other. And the work that I'm doing with the Mixtape Museum needs, you know, the work that Martha was doing with the Hip Hop Education Center.
And what is the Mixtape Museum?
The Mixtape Museum is an archive project that I started to, initially it was to document the history of the hip hop mixtape DJs that were popular during the late 80s, early 90s. I realized that there was no like systematic way to find these tapes. You know, mm-hmm. You could go online. People were uploading them if they had them in their collection.
Right. You occasionally find them on YouTube or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the history of the DJs just was not documented. And some of the DJs didn't have that information. And what prompted me to do that was Justo Faison.
Justo Faison was essentially the Johnny Appleseed of mixtapes. Countless DJs credit him with raising the notoriety of the art form, which helped them come to the notice of large audiences, as well as rappers such as Cam'ron and 50 Cent. In the mid-90s, he landed at Atlantic Records as the National Director of Marketing and Promotions, and then in 1996, he started the Mixtape Awards. Past winners included DJ Green Lantern, DJ Khaled, 50 Cent, Lloyd Banks, Big Mike, Papoose, and Jadakiss. Justo died in a car accident on May 14, 2005.
He was very passionate about the history, I mean, and about the culture, which is why he started the Mixtape Awards. And that was to highlight, you know, the work that the DJs were doing using mixtapes. They were breaking records. But they were being unnoticed. So I decided
when they were being noticed by the feds.
Right. Well, yes, absolutely. Exactly. So yeah. Then that happened. And then I realized after Justo passed away, and then the whole thing happened with Drama.
As regular listeners to The Cypher will know, DJ Drama was arrested in 2007 and over 50,000 mixtapes were seized by the police.
And there were a handful of other DJs that went through the same thing. I was like, it's dying. You know, there's no more tapes on Canal Street. There's no more tapes on 14th Street.
Oh, man, my guy on 14th and 7th over there, yeah.
Right. They were all getting shut down. So it was just like, okay, it's just erased. It's just gone. So I was like, no, I have to find a way to preserve the history. Mm-hmm. So I started a website and started there and started connecting with collectors from all over the world. We tracked Doo-Wop 95 Live to like every continent. Yo,
representing Boogie Down to the fullest. Fuck all the bullshit and 9-5, I'm coming with the full clip. Automatic.
DJ Doo-Wop's mixtape 95 Live, released in the winter of 1995, is generally considered one of the greatest mixtapes of all time. It contains freestyles from a who's who of MCs of the era, including Q-Tip, Guru, Busta Rhymes, KRS-One, Fat Joe, the Wu-Tang Clan, and many more.
But people had the tape, like, all over the world. Right. So I was interested in knowing, like, how people got those tapes. And there are stories behind how people got them. They didn't necessarily come to the city to get them. A cousin might have visited them in Japan or... Mm-hmm. By some other means. So I was interested in getting the whole story.
Okay. Cool. And so the Hip Hop Education Center, one of the main things, you know, you do, one of the main initiatives is just trying to track who's using hip hop in education throughout the country and trying to get all of these initiatives, basically kind of list them all and see what people are up to. How do you find that out?
Yes. Well, yes, yeah, it's global, by the way.
Global,
we are tracking these programs globally, and we are mapping them out in different ways. The first scan that we did, we discovered over 300 programs in high schools, in after-school programs, summer camps, in correctional facilities. And, you know, we sent out a survey, and about 200 people took the survey, but then word of mouth got out and people started telling me, like, look at this program, look at this program. And so we started to document it. So, yes, part of our mission is to archive these programs, map them out, and figure out how they're making an impact and to replicate them, hopefully replicate them, right? Because we know that in some cases, there are organizations that raise $1 million a year to do the programs. Other programs are like $500. Right. And, you know, basically, and what, you know, most people have passion projects. They just feel like they need to do it. They'll do it for free. And it's almost like the record industry, right? You know, you have your commercial, your independent artists. And so we want hip-hop to be integrated in K-12 at a minimum in public schools. And in order to do that, we have to gather more evidence. So in addition to mapping, we're doing case studies. So we did a case study for the Annie Casey Foundation. They mm-hmm. gave us three cities. They said Providence, Rhode Island, San Antonio, Texas, and Baltimore, Maryland.
Right.
These have three young mayors. See what they're doing with hip-hop.
Right.
And what we discovered was that Rhode Island, Providence, had the most exciting hip-hop programs, and that they had a unified partnerships with the government, with nonprofits, with different corporations. And it was the perfect model city. And San Antonio was a city that didn't have any support, any hip-hop education initiatives that were being funded or supported by the government. And they were urging us, the teaching artists, please help us. We're working out of bars.
Right.
We're working out of garages. We need your support. We need an introduction to the DOE, Department of Education. And then Baltimore was that middle ground where you found one organization that got $1 million grant from the feds to do hip-hop and health, mm-hmm. hip-hop and health initiative. But then they had scattered organizations, grassroots organizations, and maybe a few hip-hop scholars at the university level. So we do a lot of comparison now because that helps us understand how we can maneuver through the political system.
And why did Providence work? What was the sort of combination of factors?
I think it was a lot of the liberal, political people. I mean, you're laughing, but it's true. I think it's a lot of the, you know, the liberals that were interested in the arts and who were supporting, you know, hip-hop artists. And, you know, I think it's a combination that they had money, mm-hmm. that they had heart.
They also have a great history of nonprofit art spaces in the city. AS220 is obviously very famous.
AS220 is a nonprofit community art center in Providence that was founded in 1985. Its growth since that time is credited with helping spark the creation of an arts and entertainment district in the city.
Yes, and the whole nonprofit movement is strong. And so they wanted to take a risk, and they had a problem with black and brown youth. And so they tried it, and it worked. Mm-hmm. And so I think the mayor, you know, often visit the centers that have hip-hop. You know, they have AS220, which has a studio, which has not only a beat-making studio, art studio. They have a dance studio. You know, they really work well with the community to make sure that the needs are met. Mm-hmm. And not just for young people, but for elderly, too.
Yeah.
So nice. It's a unique city.
Nice. Why is hip-hop useful in education? To get to the very kind of basic question, right? Where does it... How does it succeed in ways that more standard methods don't? How does it reach people? Why does it succeed as opposed to, you know, any other kind of art form or, you know, anything else you can sort of add to education?
Okay. Well, first off, you know, hip hop is the popular culture. It is everywhere. It is in, you know, the radio and in the movies, television, in fashion. This is what young people are consuming. And so it just makes sense that we begin there, where young people are at and what they like. Mm-hmm. Secondly, this is part of, you know, a long legacy of African-American culture, of African culture, Latino culture. And the people, the young people that are failing and dropping out of school, most of them are Black and Latinos. And they probably don't feel engaging in school because they don't feel connected to what is being taught. So if we had more history that they can connect to, they would probably be more interested in schools. But it also has all these critical factors on, you know, how to think, how to read the world. For me, I am a first-generation Colombian-American. I had no family here. And hip-hop became my family. And listening to the hip-hop artists, I learned about the world. I learned about my history. And when I hung out in the schoolyard or in the battles, the b-boy battles, b-girl battles, that was my family, my extended family. And so it is a network of information. It's a network of people that you could learn from, and you know, it has this peer-to-peer learning experience that, you know, you take away and keep for the rest of your life, this family. Mm-hmm. And so I think it just makes total sense that we include hip-hop in the classroom.
Okay. And Summer, anything to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think naturally hip hop is inclusive, right? I grew up downtown Manhattan. I was a ballet dancer, and that was what I did 6 days a week. I found hip hop through my parents at a Jazzy Jeff Fresh Prince concert at Union Square. That was like my first, you know.
Oh, wow.
Right. So kind of weird. And then I Salt and Pepper vinyl, this, that, or the other. And then I started exploring it. But my parents were always listening to all types of music. Mm-hmm. But I, most of the time, I was listening to classical music. So I didn't really feel like I was, as I was listening to it, I think I started to identify with it when I was in high school. I went to all girls Catholic school. But we listened to hip hop. Like, all the girls in my school were from different places. I mean, all over the city. But we spent lunchtime like listening to music when we could. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until when I got into college where I started to. My cousin, my family grew up with the Clips and Pharrell, and where I started going to clubs and stuff like that, and really started to like be around it. Mm-hmm. So it took me a little longer. My mom wasn't letting me out the house to go to the clubs, and I live right up the street from the Palladium, you know? But I started really getting into it from the business side, and that's when I realized that I could be included. So it wasn't like just as a listener, but I could be involved in the process, right? As far as education's concerned, I'll use an example. I mentor students that want to go into tech, young men of color, through an organization called All Star Code. And I was at a hackathon, and they were listening to hip-hop. And that's what they were working with. They were collaborating. They were, you know, building their apps and robots, whatever else that they were building. And they started freestyling. Like, I guess when they hit a rough spot and they were like, okay, we need a break. This is our lunchtime. It was like 30 kids in a cypher, and they just started like rapping about coding. You know, it was weird. So, and the kids that were there, a lot of them were already experienced coders, but some of them were not. Mm-hmm. And so the kids that were not, that were slow in getting into groups, it was at that moment when they started the cypher, that's when they started to feel comfortable. So after that, you saw them really like all working together after lunch. So the point is, I think that the inclusion is important. You know, students listen to music and they really, I'm going off. Sorry.
No, it's true. It's a culture that's inclusive and accessible, right? And it helps to, it encourages us, it pushes us to become the best that we can be. And so the elements of hip hop are important to talk about. I mean, this is interdisciplinary in expression. Mm-hmm. Like, you could, if you can't MC, you could dance. If you can't dance, well, you could DJ. If you can't DJ, you can do visuals, right? Yeah. Graffiti and aerosol art. If you can't do that, you could beatbox. If you can't do that, well, you have style. Well, okay, maybe you could do a fashion night. Well, okay, maybe you can't do that. Maybe you could be a hip-hop scholar. Maybe you can be a teaching artist, and on and on and on. And the careers are endless within hip hop, right? You can be an engineer, you could be a radio host, you could. And so I think that is important, that hip hop not only gives you life skills, mm-hmm. it gives you career skills and career opportunities. And because of the network, you are connected. You have that social capital to make things happen. That do-it-yourself mindset is what allows a hip-hop member, right, for lack of a better word, to meet their potential, right? Yeah. And we do that with hip-hop-based education. You know, we make sure that not only do you know the history, but you develop yourself and your identity, your voice, and then you and then find a way to self-sustain yourself. Mm-hmm. And you can't complain and say, I can't do it. Well, how? No, it's all there. The tools and resources are there. You just got to grab it. You got to just develop it.
So as far as archiving, which, you know, Summer, you mentioned first about, you know, there's a panel on archiving hip hop stuff, and that was a commonality where you two met. We've had, you know, Bill Adler is a good friend of the show. We've had him on a bunch of times. Joe Conzo has been on. So regular listeners are familiar with Cornell's efforts, obviously, as far as hip hop archiving goes, and the huge collection they've built up of, you know, visual media, of records, of all kinds of stuff.
The Cornell University Hip Hop Collection contains archives from Bill Adler, photographers Joe Conzo and Ernie Panicoli, Buddy the Flyer King Esquire, graffiti legend Richard Sean Mirando, breakbeat Lenny Roberts, longtime Rocksteady crew member Jorge Popmaster Fable Pabon, Africa Bambaataa, and more.
There are other efforts as well at, you know, Harvard and a few different places. What is the world of archiving hip hop missing? What should be there and isn't?
Well, with education, with hip-hop education, when we did the scan, right, we discovered that 74% of the programs included the fifth element of hip-hop. Now, the fifth element of hip-hop is knowledge of self and your community, the history of hip-hop. Mm-hmm. And so the 26% of the programs that didn't include the fifth element, that you know, was a problem for us. And so we needed to figure out a way to make sure that everyone was on the same page and that the fifth element was included in hip-hop-based education. Mm-hmm. In some cases, these were just people who had a dance studio and wanted to do, like, a hip-hop dance class. In other cases, people just really did not want to include certain pioneers because they had, you know, beef or the wrong history, or just for whatever reason, they left the history out. And archives provide us with this information. And I don't know if Bill and Joe told you, but I produced a symposium on archiving and preservation at the Schomburg, the first one of its kind, where I gathered all of these institutions that are collecting hip hop. And this also includes the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Experience Experience Museum in Seattle, the University of Houston, Howard University, on and on and on. And I also invited some collectors, independent collectors, and Bill was one of them, and that's how he connected to Cornell University.
Oh.
Yes. And so I got together with the Schomburg, Cornell University, and the Smithsonian's American History Museum to host this event, because we don't know what people are collecting, and we need this for our own history's sake. Some of the books that are being published, you know, in some ways they're kind of biased because they only interview certain people, and we need to know the entire history in order to know the truth. And maybe we won't know all of the truth, but at least we know what, where to find it and where to mine the knowledge. And I think archiving is critical to hip-hop-based education. And now that we can go and visit these institutions, and actually in my NYU course, Hip-Hop Trails, I Skyped in Ben Ortiz from Cornell, while he was in the vault to show us pieces. So my students were bugging out, like, what? Oh, my God. Right next to, you know, all these other artifacts. And he's showing us, yeah, this is, you know, this person and Joe's. And that. And so, you know, it is important. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. I think also it's important to get the community involved. And I think having museums like this and archives available to the public are the start of that. I think a lot of people don't realize how useful they can be to helping build the history. Because people, I think naturally hip-hop fans, we collect things, right? Mm-hmm. Flyers, shirts, mixtapes, tons of stuff, you know? And we have them in our basements, in our attics, and they're just sitting there. So I think, you know, part of the education part of that is, you know, teaching people that they... giving people access, A, to contributing, which is why we're building, like, the timeline, a hip-hop timeline on the hip-hop education website where people can contribute important dates in hip-hop. So the community aspect to me is the big part. And taking it away, not necessarily taking it, making the academy, like the people on the inside, the teachers, the archives, the Cornells, the Harvards, you know, people don't know that they have access. Even artists, like hip-hop artists, are not necessarily, you know, comfortable with going or giving their stuff to Harvard or Cornell. There needs to be someone that's connected both sides, and which is, you know, what hip-hop education is serving as, that intermediate party, right?
Yeah.
So,
and until we have a hip hop museum, you know, people have to go to these institutions. And that means you have to go to all the way up to Ithaca.
It's far.
Yeah. Know, 4 hours took the from drive. New York City.
Yeah.
Or you got to go 4 hours to Harvard. Or you got, you know, and so, I mean, the Schomburg, I donated over 400 hip hop films from the film festival. I kept all of the films and I knew that they were valuable. And I donated it to them, and hopefully they'll process it this year so they can make it accessible to the community. Because you don't want an institution to take your collection and hold on to it and not process it and make it available to the people. So that's the other thing. And so we're very new at this archiving world, and so we have to learn, you know, what it is to have create a deed, the copyright issues that come along with archives, and then accessibility. Like, what do you want people to see, and what don't you want them to see?
Well, speaking of accessibility, why haven't more New York City-based institutions really stepped up? Why has it been, you know, places in Ithaca and Massachusetts and Seattle and all of these cities that aren't where hip hop was born, you know, stepping up to lead the archival efforts?
Well, there are a couple of issues. I think one of the biggest issues is that, again, we don't agree. The hip hop pioneers don't agree on the history. And I think, you know, I can't blame just the institutions. We have to have some accountability. And, you know, hip hop has had its fair share of arguments where, you know, if I was an outsider, I would think that we're crazy. Like, I don't know if I want to mess with these people who are with guns, you know, fighting, calling each other names, and then having scandals. You know, if we had an alliance, if we had, if the moguls got together and each gave $1 million, we could easily have this museum overnight. But you know, that's another issue, is that we're also very, we have our own agenda. Everyone has their own agenda. And someone from a third generation of hip hop may not be interested in saving the first generation's history. And so there's a lot, it's complex. You know, it's very complicated, and I can't really give you one answer. It's just, we have to get our shit together.
Right.
That's really it.
Yeah. So, Martha, speaking of hip hop and film and all you've done with that, one of the greatest hip hop film experiences I ever had was when you graciously allowed me to see an early cut of Time Is Illmatic before it, you know, a few weeks before it was out in film festivals.
Nas, Time Is Illmatic is a 2014 documentary film about Nas, directed by 1-9 and produced by 1-9, Eric Parker, and Anthony Sala, that recounts the circumstances in Nas's life leading up to the creation of Illmatic.
You're credited as an associate producer on that, but I get the feeling your involvement was pretty heavy. What exactly did you do on the film?
Well, you know, the idea definitely was not mine. It was Eric's idea, and 1-9 jumped on that idea and really helped him develop the story by shooting right away. And it took 10 years to make, you know. And
yeah.
So I came in like 3 years into their filmmaking. And I noticed that they were just focusing more on the music side. They were, you know, focusing on the producers. And that was fine. That was fine. But I felt like, wait, you're missing out on the lyrics. You're missing out on the historical factor. But once they interviewed Oludara.
To survive here with a family at that time was hell, believe me, especially if you didn't have any help. And we had no help.
Oludara is Nas's dad.
I think they really started to understand that way, yes, this is a legacy piece, and that we really have to talk about family history.
Well, I mean, his brother gives some of the best moments in the whole movie.
One day they had a crazy fight, and my father never came back. And I used to look out the window, and my mom told me he was never coming back to the house. She said he can't come in if he do knock on the door. And I'm there, and she ain't there, don't let him in. And that shit just, that shit fucked me up in the mind a little bit, because I was so young. My mom's never dealt with me as a kid. She always talked to me as if I was her age, or I was smart enough to know anything that's going on, so.
Yes, and, you know, being that, you know, there were so many initiatives with the Black Male Initiatives, and this was before Black Lives Matter. You know, there was the Black Male Initiative, which, you know, was talking about the dropout rates, the incarceration rates, and Queensbridge is like, you know, a place where you could study a case study of the Black Male achievement. And for Nas to make it out of Queensbridge, that's a success story. And so I pushed them to think about what is legacy, and how is Nas's history an achievement connected to the American dream. How is it different and how is it similar? And in some ways, you know, we think that by graduating high school, going to college, you know, getting your house, your family and your dog, that's success. Well, for him, it wasn't that. He dropped out of school. He became an MC. He beat the odds. You know, his best friend got shot. And so there's so many layers to this story that I just wanted them to just really think about it as an educational piece, because there were many more Nas's out there. Mm-hmm. And we need to reach them and inspire them and encourage them to keep going. Okay. So that was it. And, you know, I might have connected them to some artists or some people like Ralph McDaniels, and Ralph has footage, you know, archival footage. I might have helped with some of the crew and just connecting them to their lawyer, you know, things like that. As a, you know, as a producer, like, that's what I do. I try to solve problems and provide the resources. And it was a great experience working with them. They visually have all the talent, story-wise. I mean, they're a great team, and you're going to see much more work coming out from them soon.
And what was it like to see something that was 10 years in the making, or I guess 7 years in the making for you, finally come to fruition?
I mean, it was beautiful. It was... this wasn't my first time working with a first-time filmmaker. You know, Ted Demme was a first-time filmmaker. Frank Reyes was a first-time filmmaker. I've worked with Dream Hampton. I've worked with V Bravo. I've worked with a lot of first-time filmmakers. And it takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. So I was used to it. And I kept telling them that, don't worry, you know, this takes time. A masterpiece takes time. And when it... you know, happened, when it was completed, it was just, see, look how beautiful it is. And this is going to live on. Like, we haven't even launched the education.
Right. I know you are developing curriculum around it.
Yes. And that's part of the Hip Hop Education Center, that we develop curriculum, that we do professional development workshops, that we do these think tanks where we bring together thought leaders, seasoned leaders to come together to create standards to professionalize hip hop education. And we're doing it on our terms. And this is where I say, we got to get our shit together. This is how you do it. You unite people. You tell people, this is what needs to get done. And people will do it. It's just that I think, you know, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. And Summer, I couldn't let you go without asking about your time. You work with, you hinted at this before, with the Thornton Brothers, with Clips. What did you do?
I started out as my cousin's assistant, Jeezy, who was their manager at the time. I speak the gospel, hostile. Tony
doing time for what he did, the nostrils. Paranoid. Anthony, Jeezy Gonzalez is Clips' former manager. As Summer alludes to later in the interview, he was arrested in 2008 on charges of leading a multi-million-dollar drug ring and was sentenced to 32 years in prison.
I was his assistant. And then after some years, because I was the only one in the city, everyone else was in Virginia, I was the one running around the city, going to the labels, doing this, that, or the other. And then I started booking their tours. And it was probably that was like where I got most of my experience in on the music business side. And then from there, I was able to like Martha said before, with hip hop, once you're in it,
yeah,
you learn from people and you can collaborate with other people and do other things. So it was amazing. Wow. It really was amazing. So I worked with them for almost 10 years.
Wow. And when you were booking their tours and stuff, what around when was this?
So this was after Lord Willing, so after their second album. Mm-hmm. First one was The Funeral. But it was, yeah. That the Lord Willing was the first album that came out on a label.
Right. Right.
So up until... so there was the We Got It For Cheap mixtape series, and then there was Mr. Me Too. So I would say like 2007, 2008.
Okay.
Is when I started to do other things and develop myself as a,
right,
not just, you know, working with the Clips, because that's what I was known for, I wanted to do other things on my own.
Yeah. Well, I ask about that because we've had now No Malice on the show.
I listened to that, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I was curious about this era around the time of between the first and second album when they were releasing the mixtapes. And they started performing at places like the Knitting Factory.
Yes.
And things like that. And, you know, so what was that like for you to kind of have them transition into a different kind of venue, to put it euphemistically, for maybe the first
right.
time?
Well, first of all, the mixtape series, I have to credit Justo to actually helping me distribute that on the streets of New York, because I had no idea how to do that. We were working with Clinton Sparks at the time. He had mixunit.com mm-hmm. with Mike Rios, which was a mixtape website. They sold t-shirts and stuff like that. So we knew we had online on lock, right? But we didn't know. I was like, well, can I walk to 14th Street up the block from where I live and just give this guy tapes? He's going to be like, who are you? So Nancy Byron, who was a publicist, she is a publicist at the time. She connected me with Justo. And he was like, I don't like the Clips. I hate their music, but I'm going to help you. And he helped me. And the mixtape, I mean, at the end of that year, the mixtape was named one of the best mixtapes for that year. The second one, also amazing. The third one, because by that time, the label got more involved. But that mixtape is what helped us secure our deal and helped us book those shows. So at the time when we were going to court with Jive and going through that whole thing. Bro, these are the days of our lives, and I'm sorry to the
fans, but them crackers won't play a fair job. I know, yep. Clips' album Lord Willin was released on the Neptunes label Star Trek, which was part of Arista. But around the time Clips was working on a follow-up, a series of corporate mergers meant that Arista dissolved and the group was now signed to Jive. All the other acts on Star Trek were allowed to follow the Neptunes to Interscope, but Clips were stuck at Jive due to contractual obligations.
I mean, I was playing publicist, booking agent, and, you know, psychiatrist all at the same time. But I really had to learn how to book them. I just did it, you know, and it was connecting with, like, the Knitting Factories and the Irving Plazas and the small, like, I don't know, like Pink Pigs or whatever, those little small venues that you find around the country. And then I connected with a lot of my friends that were booking agents, and we just made it work.
That was quite a period for them, you know, in between the first two records. And you said you were playing psychiatrist. What was their mind state like at the time, being in that kind of label limbo?
It was very upsetting for them, especially since by that time Pharrell was doing his own thing, but they were kind of like stuck.
Right.
You know, and I wasn't around early on. I didn't grow up with them in Virginia, so I wasn't there for that. But that's why I felt like, because I was so connected through my cousin and connected, you know, it was like a family, you know? I really felt like I was like, what do you want to do? Like, what do we want to do? We want shows. It was the only way to make money because we weren't putting out an album. The mixtape, we weren't really making money off of it, right? We were making money through, you know, being on the road.
Yeah.
So it was upsetting for them. But to come out of that was amazing.
Sure. And they had the, you know, most critically acclaimed album of, you know, Hell Hath No Fury.
Right. Hell Hath No Fury was amazing.
Yeah.
And it was, I think, for that when I was involved through the whole process. So, you know, building the marketing plan and being at the label, being in the city, like being right up the street from the label and, you know, helping them develop the whole thing and then seeing it all the way through to another tour, which I was involved in booking too.
That's great. So what was that like? You see the XXL reviews.
In the November 2006 issue of XXL, reviewer Brendan Frederick gave Hell Hath No Fury a perfect XXL score. It was at that point only the fourth such score the magazine had ever given out.
Five-star reviews
the
all over the place.
The XXL review, I actually, it's funny because I ran into Vanessa Satine not too long ago. She doesn't remember me, and that's fine. But I pitched that story. And they were like, the Clips, they're not doing anything. And I was like, but this is happening. And they got, I think it was like a 7-page spread. Mm-hmm. I still have like a few copies of those magazines. But that's what helped. The mixtape and that story is what helped us.
Yeah.
Like get our next label, you know. So now it's just amazing, you know, seeing Pusha as president of good music.
Right.
And and no malice. He's happy. You know, he's writing more books and dictating what he wants to do the way he wants to do it, and that makes him happy. So, and my cousin will be home in less than 9 months.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's another.
That's great. That's great. Martha, I wanted to ask, so much of your writing around hip-hop education, and you mentioned it even here, this idea of the fifth element.
I'm sorry, can I just say?
Sure.
So this is why I got with Summer, got together with her, because, you know, we're two women from the entertainment industry backgrounds. You know, we know how to execute projects. We know how to develop artists. We know how to help people, you know, become superstars.
Yeah.
And it's hard being a woman in the industry. Mm-hmm. And I heard your interview with Lisa Cortez, mm-hmm. my sister, my Colombian sister. and, you know, I feel like we're an extension of her legacy. Like, we definitely have followed her steps, and we can relate. And, you know, this is a much needed space for a safe space for other women to join us. And so we are recruiting more women and mentoring more women, because we know that we're behind the scenes, but we're making major moves. And most of the people in hip hop and education that are teaching artists are women, but we don't really talk about that.
Right. And you've had initiatives around that for a long time, right? You had the Ladies First Fund, was it Womanhood First Project, and all kinds of stuff like
Fresh
that
Bold,
going
Soul
back
Def.
Years.
Yep.
Yeah, Fresh Fly. Was Fresh Fly?
Fresh, Bold, and Soul Deaf.
Right.
Women. In
Which
hip-hop.
Is, yeah. So that is a sort of ongoing project, maybe a book.
Yes.
Yeah. What is that?
Well, now that Summer and I got together, we are rebranding the whole everything. So we meet weekly, and we're populating the website. So we're doing a soft launch in July, and you'll get to see all of this content that
the original thing was profiles of a couple hundred women in hip hop, right? One for every day of the year.
365 women.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And so that will still be, that blog will be part of it. We're going to have a timeline. We're going to have the book. Mm-hmm. And the Ladies First Fund is the first women in hip hop grant that I raised money to give to women who had initiatives in education. And we gave them like $2,000 each. And, you know, that takes a lot of effort to raise money to give away. So hopefully we'll bring that back later mm-hmm. on. We just want to launch. We have so much content that we've been developing over the years that people need to see and jump on board and use the platform, because we have, you know, tools that you can use not only in the classroom, but as an adult, if you want to create your own timeline, you could do that. You can map out your story.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to connect with a organization that has that offers courses or workshops, we'll have a map so that you can find them. We're also going to map out landmarks. Because like the Underground Railroad, we have a trail that we've been leaving behind, and this is part of our history.
Oh. And, you know, one thing that I wanted to get into is, you know, you raised the idea of the fifth element earlier, which leads to, you know, Zulu Nation, leads to Bambaataa. And, you know, prior to recent incidents, he's been a large part of your, you know, you mention him in a lot of your writings and your talk about hip hop education and, you know, his legacy and his ideas and all this stuff. I guess just first off, how did you feel when the stuff about him and about the sexual abuse started coming out?
Shocking. I was in shock. You know, I just, my heart was broken. And, you know, for years we heard rumors that he might be gay. And, you know, that doesn't bother me or most of the people in his circle. No one really cares if you're gay in hip hop. But when the child abuse case, you know, came out, the alleged, allegedly, right?
Yeah.
Child abuse cases came out. That's when I said, oh, shit, you know, I'm sorry. He could be the godfather, but he has to be held accountable. And I'm actually, I just graduated from an archiving program at NYU, and I wasn't able to respond to this. But I plan on writing something, an open letter to him, mm-hmm. because if this is true, you know, he let us down. And, you know, he needs to apologize. He needs to, you know, get help. What we don't understand is that this is a mental illness. He's ill. If this is true, he is ill. And, you know, if we look at the U.S. and you look at the sex offenders mm-hmm. that live around us, we have sex offenders all around us. This is an epidemic. And perhaps I see that Bambaataa not only gives us the fifth element, right, for us to remember that it's about ourselves, the knowledge of self and the community. But once again, he is challenging us and saying, well, you know, I have a problem. How are you going to help me? How are we going to address this? Are you going to, you know, persecute me? Or are we going to talk about this? The community hasn't talked about it. We have not had a town hall discussion. We have not even discussed mental illness as part of this case. And it's a problem. So the Hip Hop Education Center will address it shortly. Mm-hmm. But it was heartbreaking, of course. And it doesn't take away from his contributions.
I was going to ask, did it change at all the way you thought about his ideas?
No, I think the universe sent him to give us the fifth element of hip hop. And once again, he's giving us another opportunity to learn from this, you know, personal issue. It has nothing to do with Zulu Nation, even though if members of the Zulu Nation did know about this, they should be held accountable as well.
Sure. And, you know, so what is going on right now for both of you with the Hip Hop Education Center, or with any other stuff you have going on? Congratulations on your graduation. I guess most importantly, are you finally done with school? You were at NYU, you were at Columbia, were here, you were there for so long, for the past like 7-8 years.
Yes.
Are you finally done with school?
I am done, and I actually resigned from teaching at NYU. So I am working solely on the Hip Hop Education Center and archiving. I work for Parkwood. I work for the Queen Bee as a project archivist, and I'm learning a lot from her collection. And
Parkwood is?
Beyonce's entertainment company.
Ah.
And I am still working with Cornell University, and we're planning a second symposium on archiving and preservation. And what else, Summer? What else we doing?
Yeah, so what else is going on?
Hip-hop hacks.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
hip-hop hacks.
About hip-hop hacks.
Yeah, so hip-hop hacks happened April 2nd, April 3rd, April 2nd and April 3rd at Spotify. The plan was for it to be a one-off, but it was an amazing, amazing event. We had over 600 students, and it sprouted from that event where I said I saw the students rapping about code. So I teamed up with some of them to do hip-hop hacks. And essentially what it is a workshop where the kids get to explore code, but then they also get to explore the elements of hip-hop. So we had workshops, coding workshops, and also DJing workshops, hip-hop and journalism. Martha led a hip-hop history workshop using the timeline, hip-hop education timeline. But now we've gotten inquiries from so many people, including hip-hop artists, to team up. So we're looking to work with other organizations, schools, talking to a few schools, after-school programs, to do smaller bursts of hip-hop hacks. And then we'll do another two-day next year sometime.
Great. And where can people keep abreast of all your efforts?
Well, I have one more thing before.
Of course.
So we're curating programs. And so I have a documentary series with the Museum of the Moving Image in Queens. I have a film series at Rikers Island called Real Justice with the Center for Justice at Columbia. And we're bringing back the film festival. It's going to be an all-year-round film festival. We've been doing it already by doing different screenings, but now we are getting the calls from studios like Focus, and one of the films that we're going to screen is Kicks, which is a narrative that is being released in August or September.
What up, boy? We got them shoes for you.
So we're curating more and more content, but mostly media, because again, media and technology is how we reach young people. And, you know, we view hip hop, both the negative and the positive, as all good. You know, we need everything in order to learn. So, yeah.
Right. All right. Well, it sounds like a great
point. And we're shouting out all the women in tech. Right,
yes.
Because this is a space that is mostly connected to men, and you know the Mark Zuckerbergs and all of that. But you know, women of color are part of it too, and so we're ringing the alarm, yeah, and saying, "Hey, we exist, and here we are." So a lot of fresh, bold, and so deaf women coming out your way.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Summer and Martha, for hanging out with us.
Oh, yay.
Talking to Martha and Summer reminded me exactly how huge an impact hip-hop has had on the world. From the silver screen to the classroom and beyond, hip-hop culture is playing a key role pretty much everywhere you look. It was great to talk to some people on the front lines of keeping that impact going while preserving the culture's past. Join us next week when our guest will be Sugar T. Sugar is a member of The Click, the Bay Area rap group whose best-known member is her brother, E-40. Sugar T has made a huge impact both solo and as a member of the group, enough so that she was recognized at this year's VH1 Hip Hop Honors Awards show. Like I said at the beginning, make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to The Cypher on your podcast app of choice. If that app is iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating or a review. And don't forget to visit patreon.com/thecyphershow if you enjoy the program, and help us out with as little as $1 a month. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
I wasn't making money. I wasn't sustaining myself.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
It was amazing.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Hip Mundo.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I mean, I was playing publicist, booking agent, and, you know, psychiatrist all at the same time.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Lamar Johnson.
What do you want?
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
We don't need hip hop. Cornell has that covered.